Stress a little bit. See where I'm at here. We've been dealing with, we looked, first of all, the person of the Godhead. Now we saw that he's the Trinity. We saw his essence, and we saw that he is a sovereign God who has a plan. And that plan is a very detailed plan, including everything that happens. Has it so detailed that even the hairs of our head are numbered. There's not a sparrow that drops from the sky that he is not aware of. He knows everything. And so he's a great God. He's a very mighty God who is concerned and has us in his mind. The second thing that we looked at is, the second thing that we're looking at is man. I think the last time or the time before that, we talked about man being made in the image of God. Being made in the image of God had nothing to do with our external looks or our features. It has to do with what we are inside. And what makes us different than all the rest of the animal kingdom is that God gave us a personality. We have intellect, emotion, and will. I'm not sure what other animals have. I suspect they have some intellect. And they may have a personality, they are very limited. I'm not sure about the animal kingdom, but we are different than the animal kingdom in the sense that we were made in the likeness and image of God. Animals are never said to be made in that way. So God made us after their image, God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit. That image was good. Man was made, and when God saw the creation, all of his creation, that creation was good. Something happened, and I can't answer all the questions that you may have in regard to that, but God did plan that he was going to reveal his grace to mankind and was going to do something for him, and so he had to bring about circumstances in which man, as well as the angels, and you remember Lucifer was the first sinner, and he sinned while he was yet in heaven. And we have that in Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28, the fall of Lucifer. Sin entered the world by Adam, by one man, Adam. And God permitted that in some way, holding man responsible for that sin. He had a will, I guess, if you want to call that will, to be free. Adam had a choice to make, and he made a choice. The angels had a choice to make, and they made a choice. Again, I assume that there were elect angels, we know that, and if God had not had elect angels, I assume that all the angels would have fallen with Lucifer. But God restrained at least two-thirds of them, one-third of the angels fell with Lucifer, and they became the Satan's army or the demons ministering in this world in various ways. They become ministers of light. But they are ministers of death in every respect. Man fell, and something happened to his character, and his character became corrupted. His personality became corrupted. And he assumed or was given at that particular point a conscience. Man now has the ability to discern or to know the difference between good and evil. And that we call the conscience. And if you're a dispensationalist, which I trust that you are, a dispensationalist is one who believes that God ministers or works in the affairs of man in different ways at different times. And in the second dispensation, in the first dispensation, we call that the Age of Innocence, in which God dealt with man, met with man on the basis of his complete innocence. He did not know good or evil. God gave him no commands to up until that point that he was not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, but he was free to do whatever he desired, and his desires were good. He did that which was right. I assume that he did some things that probably were not... I shouldn't say he did that which is right. He didn't sin, and sin was not imputed to his account because there was no law. He, however, did do things that were right as well as doing things that were wrong. He was given a command in the garden, and that command was not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and the day that he did it, he would die. I tried to point out to you that death was not only began to die physically, but he also began to die spiritually, or he died spiritually. He began to die physically. He did die spiritually that day. And as a result of that spiritual death and the corruption of his nature, that was passed on to you and I down through the ages. And you and I have inherited from our Father, and it's been imputed to our account his sin, but we also inherited from him an old sin nature. And I was, I don't know if I described that old sin nature to you. I want to do a little bit of that this morning to show you how it works. We had characterized man with a circle. God created man, and let me make that a little bit bigger so you can... God created man, and he gave him a personality, intellect, emotion, and will. He breathed into him life, and he became a living soul. Now he has inherited something. With the fall, his nature became corrupt, and I define that old sin nature with a diamond, and I'll show you why in just a few moments. But his old sin nature became corrupt, and now he has also inherited an ability, a conscience, an ability to discern right from wrong. And that's the part of the promise that it was given to him of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. If he ate of that, he would have the knowledge of good and evil. And man then was put to another test. Is he going to do that which is right, or is he going to do that which is wrong? He had the ability to discern both. And if you go into Genesis chapter 9, you'll find that man did that which was evil in his own sight. He walked after his own desires and his own respect. He did that which is evil. That conscience, we're told in the New Testament, has become seared. It's become defiled, and it does not operate properly. Men cannot live righteously on the basis of their conscience today. God has given the believer the ability to purge that conscience and to fill it with the truth and to be able to function properly. But man, unaided by God, has no ability whatsoever to discern right from wrong. He does that which he thinks is right in his own mind, and he accomplishes or does all types of evil things. And I'll show you why that happens in just a few moments. Now, not only did that happen, but according to Ephesians, Satan now has an inroad into man. And he is now able to energize or to work within mankind to operate and to minister to that man or accomplish through that man what he wants to accomplish. Everyone that is born into this world is born in this world with a personality, with an old sin nature. He is as a soul. He has a conscience. He has a spirit, by the way, and that is a human spirit. He is given a human spirit, which God breathed into him. And he also now is energized by Satan. And that is found, by the way, in Ephesians chapter 2 and verses 2 and 3, I believe it is, that you can read about that. That is, the God of this age is working in us. And also, that's a major passage that we have to look at. Now, do you have any questions at this particular point? Because I just want to expand on that just a little bit before we move on. Any questions? Yes. He doesn't have the ability, as far as God's concerned, in God's righteousness, to choose that which is right in God's sight.
Is that nothing to do with the rights and wrongs? Are there people who aren't Christians?
There are people who do good things. Yeah. I want to clarify that. Yeah. He cannot do that which is right in the eyes of God that is acceptable to God. All right. Yes, there is common grace that ministers to man. Certainly, man makes decisions that are that appear to be right and appear to be good, and they do good things. But that righteousness or those good works are not acceptable to God. Okay, so I should clarify that. Yeah, he doesn't have the ability to discern and to understand the things that God has given him. So he, or that, let me clarify that. He does not have the ability to do anything that is acceptable to God. Two weeks ago, I mentioned the term depravity. Did I mention that in this class, total depravity? And I was saying that man is not as bad as he can be. In other words, he does do good things. But the good things that he does is unacceptable to God. All right? Isaiah 64 says, all our righteousnesses are as filthy rags. And it's not by works of righteousness which we do that we become acceptable to God. Man does things that are his own righteousness, which he sees in his own eyes as being that which is good. That is true. Right, that is correct. I will get into that in just a little bit, because I want to show you the difference between what happens in the believer's life versus that which happens in the unbeliever's life. I'm glad you clarify that. Anybody else? Now, man will do things which are right in his own eyes, but not that which is acceptable or right in the sight of God. All right. We discussed the fact that there's one other thing I had to put in here for you. When you were born, you were connected to Adam in some way. And I'm not sure that the terminology is correct, but I'm going to give it to you anyhow. I call it an old man. Well, the scriptures talk about the old man. In Romans chapter 6, verse 6, it says, knowing that our old man was crucified with Christ. The old man is that which connects us to Adam. And we are joined to Adam in regard to all that we inherited from him through the old man. And when God, or when Satan works through us, the way he works through us, inside he can energize us. He also uses external circumstances. The lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. And he works through us. And it appeals to us. And the way in which he works, he takes these things and Satan uses it. He combines these things, works through the old man, through our intellect, emotion, or will, or he bypasses the intellect, comes down and works through the old sin nature to produce that which is maybe good in man's sight, or that which is bad, one or the other. He produces unacceptable to God in both cases. But he does use the external circumstances that man is in to produce and to energize him from within to produce all kinds of acts that he has in his life. Now what happens when we become a... Well, let me clarify one thing. Let's look at the old sin nature and then we'll move on. I've given this to you, most of you, before, and I just want to expand on it a little bit. The reason we use a diamond to explain the old sin nature is simply to show you four points of references that we have in regard to our nature, four areas in which that nature works. First of all, every human being that is born has an area of strength, in their lives, in which they are able to do that which is good. They can produce good. That good is not acceptable to God because it is human good. I said that every person is able to do that. I often make a joke of this. I'm sort of a Volkswagen lover, I guess, to some degree. And I said one of the great things that Hitler did was he decided he was going to make a car for the people. And he called that car the Volkswagen. And his dream was to have every person own a Volkswagen. And I suspect that would have been a pretty good thing. And of all the things that he did, I often attribute that his work of producing the Volkswagen was one of the best things that he did. And that was a good work, but it was human good. And every person, I don't care who he is, John Dillinger, Dillinger or Jeffrey Dahmer or whoever it may have been, there was something in them, as bad as they were, there was something in them that was, there was still some acts of good in them. And there was still an area of strength. And I suspect that had they been put in the right circumstances and the right times, they would do good things. You, as a believer, still retain your old sin nature. You still have an area of strength. And out of that area of strength, you produce good things. Now, the key for the Christian The key for the Christian is to be able to discern that when you're doing something good, is it coming from the old sin nature or is it coming from God? Do you see that? When you are doing that which is good, is it coming from the old sin nature or is it coming from God? That could be anything. You're attending church this morning. That's a good thing. There's nothing wrong with attending church, and you ought to attend church to learn about the Word of God. You have to question yourself, why do I attend church? Is this a work that the Spirit of God is doing in my life, or is this something that satisfies the longing that my flesh has within itself, and I have an area of strength that says that I can do this, and out of my own strength, I will go to church. Well, let me. You have to test your own motives. That's the biggest thing. Paul says, let me get my Bible. If you turn over to 2 Corinthians chapter 4, how do I test my own motives? 1 Corinthians chapter 4. Let me get it right. 1 Corinthians chapter 4. You can put yourself in this account. Paul says in verse 1, let a man account of us as of the ministers of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. Moreover, it is required of stewards that a man be found faithful. And I guess the question that you have to ask yourself, are you being faithful to God's word? And are you faithful in regard to God? But with me, it is a very small thing that I should be judged of you or of man's judgment. Yea, I judge not my own self. Let me just back up a little bit and tell you about the problem that Paul was having. Paul was having a problem with the believers. He had established a church at Corinth, and there were people who came along and said, who is Paul? What right does he have to tell you what you should do and what you shouldn't do? He's just another man. That's all he is. And Paul sort of defends himself as a minister of Christ. He does this to the Galatians. He does it with the Thessalonians because there were people who followed him and tried to undermine his ministry. And what Paul says in regard to this is interesting. He said, it's a very small thing, verse 3, that I should be judged of you or of man's judgment. Yea, I judge not my own self. For I know nothing against myself, yet I am not hereby justified, but he that judgeth me is the Lord. What he is saying is that one of the most difficult tasks that you have as a believer is to judge your own motives. Paul says, the ultimate judge of my motives has to be God. Doesn't mean that you don't scrutinize your motives and judge your own motives. He says, I don't know anything against myself. I mean, I've sat down, I've gone through this whole thing, I've gone through my life, and I've examined my life where I am right now, and I'm looking at myself, and I don't find anything wrong. But that doesn't justify me. And I think that each of us have to sit down, we have to analyze, we have to search our own lives and say, all right, am I being faithful? And what I am doing, is it out of my flesh or is it out of my spirit? Now, one of the things that is going to help you determine what that is, to see where those motives come, is to understand your own personality and your own motives. And your old sin nature. I'm sorry. Your own personality and your old sin nature. Once you understand that you do have area of strengths, what are your area of strengths in your old sin nature? What kind of a person are you apart from the Spirit of God in your life? If you can begin to discern yourself, look at your life, and you'll begin to see that there are areas of strength. Let me show you how that works. Now, there's also, at the other end of the spectrum, there's also an area of weakness. And out of that area of weakness comes personal sins. Uh, impatience, anger, jealousy. And you go on down the list of things that are personal sins. What causes you to lose your cool? What causes you to do good things? What are your areas of strength? Now, not only that, but there's also some other areas which we have to look at. There is a trend in our lives towards asceticism. Now, asceticism means that one who is denies himself. In other words, he has a built-in desire to deny himself, to be accepted, particularly by God. And out of this area, there comes what I call religion. All of us have some idea in ourselves, built within us, there is a natural process to be religious. In our, I don't know if I mentioned this in our studies, I don't know if there has been a culture that has ever existed that has not had some form of religion. That religion comes out of this area or out of this trend towards asceticism. There is a desire, there's an emptiness within inside, there's something that needs to be satisfied that is spiritual in essence, there's a vacuum that's there, and this trend towards asceticism fills that vacuum. Now there's also another trend in us, and there's a trend towards lasciviousness. Lasciviousness is lawlessness. Lawlessness. We all have that point in our lives where we say, I don't care what the consequence is, I'm going to do it. And you all have been faced with those circumstances in life where you said, I just don't care. It just doesn't matter. I'm going to do it anyhow. And that can be done out of the sweetest attitude. I have counseled couples and for marriage to be married. And if I found out that one is saved and the other is not saved, I would say to them immediately, well, I can't marry you because I do not believe that God would sanction to be unequally yoked together, and so I would not marry them. The usual response to that is, well, I really don't care. We're going to go ahead and get married anyhow. And that's out of a nice, sweet attitude. But you see, it comes out of that old sin nature that says, I really don't care what God says. I'm going to do it anyhow. And I don't care what the law says, just the natural laws or the laws of the government. I am going to do it. Whether you're driving too fast, you know, your speed limit's 55 miles an hour and you're going to drive 60 or 65 or 70. And you say, well, I don't care. Everyone else is doing it. I can break the law too. Where does that attitude come from? Where does that desire come from to go faster? Well, it comes out of this trend towards lasciviousness. And each one of us have that built-in trend. Each one of us have a trend towards asceticism, which drives us in the other area. And so you have All right. Now, what you see again, you have to understand yourself. What satisfies your trend towards asceticism? I say this from the pulpit every once in a while, and I don't do it for any other reason. But you know, there's some people that come to church and are really satisfied with coming to church. It satisfies any kind of spirit. They just come and they're here. They sit in the pulpit. They sleep during the service or whatever, and they go away and they're satisfied. And I have often told people, I would rather you stay home and sleep than come to church to sleep. And the reason I say that is because if you stay home and sleep, then you may feel guilty about it. You come to church and you sleep, you don't feel guilty about it. You say it's a boring message and you leave and you are satisfied that you've attended church. And I would dare to say that in the churches today around the world, the people who attend, probably a large number of those people attending are only there to satisfy their old sin nature. To say, well, I did what I was supposed to do. Yes, Sandy?
Thank you.
Well, it comes out of their old sin nature and what they were doing. The question is, the Pharisees, they had all their laws and regulations set up, and what produced or what motivated them to do those kind of things? Why would they set themselves up under such a stringent law such as this? I suspect there were both sides of the thing. This religious attitude and the trend towards human good, or their area of strength and their trend towards asceticism, produced in them a great desire to please God. A lot of people say, well, religion is man's attempt to reach God. I heard someone define it just the opposite. Religion is a man's way of getting away from God. Because it doesn't take you towards God, it takes you away from God. The Pharisaism was really a religious attempt to produce a righteousness that would be acceptable to God. Now, you have to understand the Jewish people. They were God's people. Let me ask you a question. Maybe we answer this. Why did God give Israel the law? Why did he give them all those commandments in the Old Testament, that thou shalt do this and thou shalt not do this, the Ten Commandments plus all the other laws that he gave them? Why did God give them all those laws? All right, to help guide them? All right, anything else? Yeah, that's right, to show them their sinfulness. What the law did... The law never justified anyone. The law could not bring about righteousness. And Israel got so bad with the people that God had chosen, Abraham, they had gotten so bad in their attitudes that God gave them the law to show them where they were wrong. Not to do that which is right, but to show them that they were wrong and to cast them upon the mercy of God to save them. Do you understand that? See, what the law did, the law sort of put a fence all the way around them. And I've drawn this for you. I made these all little gates. And each law represents a gate in this fence that goes all the way around. And if you could imagine a fence that you're corralled in, and there are hundreds and hundreds of laws that are there, and each one of them are a gate to get outside of that standard. This is the standard, the law is the standard of righteousness. And God gave them this standard of righteousness. And now look, this is the standard that I require. And Israel should have said, well, gee, I break it here. I'm outside here. And I break it over here. And I'm outside over here. And I break it here. And I break it here. And I break it there. And if that's God's standard that he has established for us, and I have to meet that standard, I do not meet that standard. Now, what am I going to do? It should have driven them to their knees. It should have driven them to the place where they sought the mercy of God and the grace of God. Do you know what they did instead? Out of their old sin nature, they said, I can do what God wants me to do. I just have to understand a little bit more, and I will define what God wants me to do. So God says that on the Sabbath, we should keep it holy. It should be a day of rest. So let's define what a day of rest is. And so they amounted 100 laws that told us, or hundreds of laws that told us what you could do on the Sabbath and what you couldn't do on the Sabbath. And they would say, well, we could travel so far on the Sabbath. If you travel so far on the Sabbath, in their case, it was about 3/5 of a mile. If we travel 3/5 of a mile, then we're not working. That's all right. That's a day of rest. If we travel more than 3/5 of a mile, then we're working, and it's not a day of rest. And so we would break the law if we travel over 3/5 of a mile. On the Sabbath day, we can't walk in the grass, because if we walk in the grass, we'll hit the little petals of the blades of grass, and the seeds will fall off and they will fall to the ground and that sowing. So we'll have to stay on the road and off the grass on the Sabbath. And so they went through all these laws to define for themselves and to make themselves acceptable to God. When God says to you that you are to be spiritual, how do you define that? See, what we do is we tend to define it by going to church, by reading the Bible, by having our devotions, by witnessing, by doing certain things. That makes us spiritual. And we do the same thing that the children of Israel does. And our old sin natures take over and it begins to define what spirituality is. And it defines it in such a way that I can do it. Now, if I go to church, you see, if I'm a regular attendant, and if I go, you know, we don't have all the other meetings, and there's reasons why we don't have all the other meetings, by the way. We don't have prayer meeting, we don't have Women's Missionary Society, and we don't have a lot of other programs here at this church. There's a reason for that. You know what the reason is? I don't want you to begin to trust on attending church for your spirituality. There's a trend to believe among many Christians that they go to church on Sunday morning, they go to Sunday school church, they go to the evening service, and they'll go to prayer meeting, and that makes them spiritual. That doesn't make a person spiritual. They do it out of this trend that they have here. And again, you have to define for yourself or have to understand your own desires and your own old sin nature so that you can begin to determine, hey, I'm doing that out of my old flesh. You get angry sometimes. You say, well, it's righteous indignation. Is it? You go to church and you say, I'm being spiritual. And I'm saying, is it? You even break the law and you say, well, I'm doing it for the right reasons and therefore it justifies me. I mean, if I took, I don't know what the speed limit is out here on this little road from 23 back to the church. It's a 2-mile stretch. I would imagine if I had a radar system set up that most of you are being late for church would come out that road about 55 miles an hour. Now, I know that speed limit's not 55 miles an hour, but you would justify going fast because you're late. Right? And you would say to yourself, I am doing the right thing because I'm going to church. And we have a tendency within us to define what is right and what's wrong by the base of how we feel or what the result is, the end result of that. It comes from the old sin nature. Now, let's look at this just a little bit more. There's also a tendency. Do you know the pendulum swings? You know how the pendulum swings back and forth? Well, we have a tendency to swing back and forth in the pendulum too. See, if you get mad at your wife, then you want to bring her flowers. You know what I mean? Or a box of candy. Now, I know all of you do that here, all you men. Or if your wives get angry with your husbands, and you know it was unjustifiable, and usually is when wives get angry at their husbands, and they want to make up for it, you know what I mean? And then they make them a nice steak dinner, or they do something that's really nice for them. And we have that tendency to swing back and forth. We do a few things that are wrong, and then we want to make up for it, and we want to do that which is right. And sometimes that's the way it is with God. You see, out of that old sin nature and out of that trend towards asceticism, sometimes we do things that are wrong. We say, now I'll make up for it. I mean, I have done some pretty raunchy things, and I'm going to start attending church now, thinking that that's going to be acceptable to God, because now I'm going to make up for what I've done. Or I'm going to put some more money in the basket this morning, and that'll make up for what I did this week. And we swing from one end to the other. Or some of you say, well, I've been going to church long enough, I'm going to take a couple Sundays off. And you think, well, you see, you swing back, oh yeah, you do some good things, now you're going to swing back to the other side. And that moves both ways, always. It goes up and down, it goes sideways, and you swing back and forth. When I see people after they haven't been here for a long time, our church is sort of unusual, I think, because we don't run after people. You know what I mean? If they're absent, I say, well, the Lord's dealing with them out there somewhere, and when they're ready to come back, they'll come back. We want folks here because they want to be here, not because I'm forcing them to be here or someone's keeping track of them all the time and checking up on them and calling them and say, why weren't you to church on Sunday? And I think, well, they're out there. God's dealing with them. And some of them are gone for a month or 2 months or 3 months, and then I see them come back again, and I think to myself, I wonder what they've done wrong now. I wonder what kind of problems they're in right now. You know, now they want to come back, and now they want to get out. And are they making up for it? Now, there's nothing wrong with that. Don't misunderstand. But sometimes you think, are they trying to make up for what they've done or what they've been doing? And that pendulum swings back and forth in our lives. And unless you can understand your old sin nature, you're not going to be able to determine that which is done by the Spirit of God versus that which is done by the flesh. I cannot tell you what your old sin nature is like, because God has created us. We're as different. I suspect that the snowflakes, and you heard me say this, that every snowflake, the scientists tell us that every snowflake that falls from heaven is different. I would like them to prove that to me sometime. They haven't. I don't think they'll be able to do that. But if it's true, when God created man, we're all different. And we can look exactly alike, and we still be different. Because each of our personalities are different. Each of our old sin natures are different. If you knew me, you could probably press the right key to get me upset. You know what I mean? I mean, you could push something here, and I would do something which would be good. Or you could press something, and you would make... Do you know you folks that are married, do you know what makes your husband angry? And do you know that if you just said the right thing, pushed the right button, he'd get angry? And do you know if you said the right thing that he would become very sweet and he would do the right thing? Or if I did something for him, he would respond positively and do something nice for me? And you begin to push these buttons and we begin to play with anything. And you know, you can look at your spouse if you've lived with them very long, and you can see what buttons to push. You know what gets them angry? You know what makes them respond the way you want them to respond? Well, do you know yourself well enough to be able to do that? Now, let me put one more key in this thing. And I just write a big L in here. And I call that our lust pattern. And each person has a lust pattern. You've heard me give these to you. There are five basic patterns. If you read any psychology books, you'll probably you'll see them list these patterns that drive man or move man to do what they do. Those lust patterns are fivefold. First of all, there is approbation. Approbation. I don't have these in any particular order, so I'm just putting them on the top of my head. Approbation. Approbation means that there is a desire to be acceptable to others. And you respond in your old sin nature and in your personality, you respond to people, and you're driven to respond to people because you want to be accepted. Now, this doesn't mean that we all don't want to be accepted. All of us like to be accepted, right? Well, almost all of us. There are some that don't care at all. But most of us want to be accepted. But you see, if you have an approbation lust, and that's your lust pattern, that is the driving force in your life in almost every circumstance that you have to do what needs to be done in order to be acceptable. Avoiding conflict would be part of it, yes. That would be a part of an approbation lust. Don't want to cause any problems, don't want to cause any ways because they'll think badly of me or they won't accept me. We talk a lot about peer pressure today. The kids do things that they wouldn't otherwise do because they want to be accepted. And that certainly is a part. That's not necessarily the approbation lust pattern. That's simply what it is, peer pressure. And they do want to be accepted by other people, and they have to learn. But that may not be the driving force in life. There's a second one, and we call that the ego lust. Ego lust, ego means I, of course. And there are some people that really just don't care about anyone else but themselves. I mean, they do everything, and they don't care what anyone else says. They do what they want to do, when they want to do it, how they want to do it. And they really don't care if anyone gets hurt. They don't care whether they're acceptable or not. They're going to do what they want to do, when they want to do it, and how they want to do it. I am not in a situation where you have large groups of people together where we get to know them. But when you were in high school, or you went to college and you got to know people and you sat in classrooms, you probably had some friends who had an ego lust. They just didn't care about anything. They just didn't care. And they would do what they wanted to do when they wanted to do it, and they didn't care who they hurt or how much they hurt someone. They did what they wanted to do when they wanted to do it. There's also a material lust that drives us. We want things, and we're going to get those things regardless of who it hurts or how we get it. We're going to get it. We can cheat, we can rob, we can steal, we can hurt people in achieving what we want to achieve. So we have an ego, we have approbation, we have material. Someone tell me the fourth one. The power lust. That's the next one that I wanted. Yeah, I'll get to the sexual lust. I had that one. I knew that one. Not that I have a sexual lust necessarily. I have a very canny lust pattern, and I have a power lust. I like to manipulate people, and I do it in a subtle way. I'm not. But anyway, the power lust. Power lust is one who likes to control all the circumstances of their life. And they do things in order to be able to manipulate people. And they manipulate people by even giving in, by giving them things, by responding very bad. I had a friend, he's no longer with us, he went on to glory. But he wanted to be able to control people. You know how he controlled people? By doing things for them. Well, I did something for you, now I expect you to do something for me. And in that way, he was able to manipulate and control individuals. He said, well, see what I did for you? And it didn't take him long if you denied it. He said, well, in his feelings, he would show it very quickly. Well, boy, you mean I did all that for you and you're not willing to do anything for me? Manipulation. And one who has a power lust begins to manipulate people to get them to do what they want them to do, and they do it in various ways. They can do it by screaming and yelling. I'll get you to do. You'll get me angry, and you're going to do what I want to do. You know what I mean? Your boss may get angry at you, or someone gets angry at you and say, well, I'm going to go do it for them, or just stop them from getting angry. And they manipulate you by their anger. The fifth lust pattern is sexual lust. A sexual lust pattern simply means that a person is driven by his own lust for sex. And he does anything and everything he possibly can do to satisfy that lust pattern, that sexual lust. And we're driven, and each one of you have, you don't have all five of them, all right? Some of you say, "Well, I fit into every one of those categories. I like to manipulate people. I really want things for myself. I want to be accepted. I have a sexual lust. I have material lust. But there is one of those that is a major driving force in your life, and you have to begin to analyze your own life and have to begin to think about yourself and to see what pushes you over, what causes you to do what you do. What causes you to lose your cool down here? What causes you to do good things? See, if I have a sexual lust, and I were in dating someone, or I want to get my way with some young woman, and there are different ways that I could do that. I could do that by being very nice to her and doing good things for her, and out of my area of strength, showing all this kindness and all that. Or I could do it from the other side. I'd get angry at her. And that might manipulate her. Or if she's a nice Christian girl, what I might do is I might attend church with her. And she will think that I'm really a nice guy. And I will be able to get my way with her. If she's a lawless type of a person, and she has a strong trend towards lawlessness, and she's on drugs, or she's a drunk, if I go and join her and be involved with her activities, she will accept me, and I will be able to have my way with her. See, it drives us in every direction. In every one of your lust patterns, that's the way, whatever one you have, that is the driving force in your life. Now, all that is a result of the fall of Adam. When Adam fell, it was the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life that drove him. It was this whole thing. And the avenues by which it works are those three avenues. You work that way also. Now, next week I'm going to take briefly, and we're going to show you what happens in the conversion of a believer. And then we want to get into the work of Jesus Christ on the cross. And I hope we can get that into that next week. So we'll close there. Thank you.